Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Hey guys, welcome back to Storytime Slayer Podcast. I am your hostess, Haley Lira, and today we are going to do part 2 of the Dee and Allen case, what's often referred to as the IHOP murders or the Pancake House murders. So where we left off, Allen got Dee to hire Mike and Bill to help him kill Art so he could take all Art's money. They seem to have gotten away with it. Dee is taking care of Art's senile mom, Bessie, and also acting as manager of the IHOP. Mike and Bill got paid, and Allen got all Art's money, which he is spending with his lover boy, Henry. The plan worked, and everyone had what they wanted. But then Dee started to feel really guilty. Before I get started on the second half, I just want to say thank you so much for tuning into my podcast. I love doing a true crime podcast. I would love for you to leave me a 5-star review on Apple. I'm not seeing those roll in. Let's get that thing going, guys. And then definitely go check me out on Facebook, Storytime Slayer. And then I'm on Instagram, not as active on Instagram, but that's story_time_slayer. With all that, let's get started. Despite nobody being suspicious, in a drunken moment of guilt, Dee told her daughter Susan everything. And if I'm not mistaken, Susan was only like 17 at the time. Susan immediately recognized her mother's guilt in the murder and told Dee that, but Dee genuinely didn't believe that it was her fault at all. For some reason, though, Dee confiding in Susan drew the women really close, and Susan started even working at IHOP with her mom, and Dee even took Susan to meet Bessie and showed her where Art's body was and everything. The most baffling thing about Dee's involvement in this crime is she genuinely didn't find herself culpable. I mean, other than some petty cash, booze, and promising Dee a job for life, Dee didn't even gain anything from Art's death. Allen was spending fistfuls of cash while Dee was still making the same amount of money, managing the IHOP, living like hand to mouth. But that didn't occur to Dee because her and Allen were spending a lot of time together and became really close. He would take her out to dinner, compliment her, manipulate her, and even act concerned about her drinking. The reality is, I think Allen caught on to Dee's girlish crush and was using this to his advantage. Allen didn't want to give Dee money, and he wanted to convince her that they needed to kill Bessie too. Allen's charm and persuasion work. Dee never asks him for money, but she eventually caves and agrees Allen could hire Mike and Bill for $2,500 to kill Bessie, but this time Mike and Bill have to take care of the body. The only thing Dee wanted in return for agreeing to have Bessie killed was for Bessie's death to be quick and painless. Allen and Dee decided that they'd go ahead and put Art's body wherever Mike and Bill bury Bessie. They decided to call an excavation company and tell them that they'd like a trash hole dug on Art's property. They tell the excavator the hole is for them to burn trash in. So for $250, excavator Wayne Tidwell agreed to use his machinery to dig them a trash hole, not knowing that they were planning to throw away bodies, of course. The first week of August, exactly 7 weeks after Art was murdered, is when Bill and Mike planned to kill Bessie and throw her in the hole. Dee knew that Bessie wouldn't just let these two men into her trailer willingly, so Dee told Bessie that two roofers were coming to take a look at her roof. It needed repairs. Mike promised Dee that it would be quick and painless death because Bill was a karate expert and he knew a spot in the back of Bessie's head that would instantly and painlessly end her life. And yeah, Dee actually believed this and gave Mike half the money, which Allen provided, of course. The following Saturday, Mike called and collected the second half of his money because the job was done. So after they got the call that the job was done, Allen and Dee drove to look in the hole for Bessie's body before paying the second half of the money. But guess what? It wasn't in the hole. So they went to the trailer and they found Bessie's lifeless body still sitting at the kitchen table slumped over. Dee and Allen were pissed, and they insisted that Mike and Bill finish the job for the rest of their pay. After some back and forth banter, Dee got Bill to agree to move Bessie's body. Wednesday, August 10th, he placed her in the hole. Dee and Allen rented equipment so that they could move the wardrobe Art was inside of to the hole on top of or near Bessie's corpse. They wanted to cover it all with dirt, but they didn't know how to use the equipment, and the ground was really hard. So instead, they just threw a bunch of stuff on top of the wardrobe and Bessie, just including trash, an old mattress, things like that. And then they called the same company that dug the hole, and they said that they needed it to be filled because a family with children was going to rent the property, and they thought the trash hole seemed rather dangerous. So the same company came out and they filled that hole, problem solved. After learning all of that, I still don't see how Dee did not find herself culpable in the deaths of Art and Bessie. As far as who killed Bessie and what exactly happened, that is to be debated because Mike and Bill have different stories. Bill's story is that Mike asked him to come help do a roofing job. Bill said yeah, and Mike picked him up at 5. As soon as they got to Bessie's trailer, Bill recognized where they were and wanted to leave. Despite that, Bill was still genuinely under the impression that they were at the trailer to fix the roof for Bessie, so he still went inside with Mike. Once inside the trailer, Bessie asked him if they could look at something wrong with her floor, too. Bill went and looked in the hallway, and when he walked back in, like, you know, to the common living area, he saw Mike strangling Bessie. Bill didn't know what to do and was scared because Mike was bigger than him, so he just went to the car. When Mike came back out to the car, Bill asked him, you know, like, what the hell was that? And Mike's response was, now we're going to be even for what happened with the guy. And Bill responded, I didn't kill the guy. I'm assuming they're referencing Art. And if you ask Mike what happened, he says the same story, but blames Bill. To explain why neither Dee nor Alan were taking Bessie food anymore, they told everyone Bessie was staying with Art in North Carolina because his trip was now extended. Okay, so I know you guys are probably wanting to know how much money did, you know, Art have when he died. When Art died, he had $33,000 in a bank account that Alan could access. By the end of July, that account had only $4,000 left, and by September, it was completely drained. Alan's second source of income was the $3,000 he stole from IHOP every week. It didn't take long, though, for the IHOP franchise headquarters to start calling, though, because the profit margins were inexplicably low. Dee begged Alan to stop taking so much money and explained IHOP was getting suspicious, but he ignored her, and she just kept letting him steal because she started to fall in love with him. Dee said at this point in the crime, she was fantasizing about having sex with Alan and caring for her when she got old. So while Alan was living his life of a high roller, Dee could not even pay her bills for the month of September. Dee's husband, Cass, had to move and go live with his family in Texas due to his declining health. And so Dee turned to Alan for money, but he couldn't give her any money even if he wanted to because he was out of money also. He did tell her that she could stay in Art's house, though, and she did. She moved in. Yeah, Dee, her daughter, Susan, and the sons that Dee had. Remember, Dee had two boys, who I think were like preteens at this point. They all move into Art's house. Susan was following in her mom's footsteps as well with drinking. And even though Dee didn't do drugs, Susan started using cocaine and partying with Alan. Dee did not participate in drugs, though. Again, only alcohol. With no money left and little profit from IHOP because Alan stole so much money every day, Dee and Alan were broke. They decided they needed to start liquidating Art's assets. So they started with Bessie's trailer. To sell Bessie's trailer for $4,000, Dee helped Alan pose as Art, and it actually worked. They were able to sell it, and Alan kept all the money. Of course. Even though they'd gotten away with the crime, Dee became a wild card. She was drinking really heavily, and she even had to be hospitalized for a couple days. Sometimes Bessie's cat would sneak into Art's home where Dee lived and attack Dee. And Dee was so paranoid and weirded out that Bessie's cat knew what she did to Bessie, she made Alan dump the cat in a random neighborhood. Do these people have no limits? While this was going on, IHOP was threatening to take back the franchise and insisted that if they could not speak to Art, they needed to speak to somebody else in management. Dee agreed to meet with them, and when she did, she blamed Art. She was like, oh, it's so unfair that Art ran off to North Carolina and instructed me to deposit the money into his account. And then he said that he was going to send the checks to y'all, but oh, I can't believe he would do this. So it looked like Art had skipped town and was stealing money from the store. Dee said that she would make sure IHOP got their money and just needed some time to get in touch and talk to Art or figure something out. And IHOP agreed to give her some time. To get the money that they owed IHOP, Dee decided she would refinance Art's house by having Alan pose as Art. And it actually worked. She got the money and she paid back IHOP. She was so proud of herself that she would get to keep her job, damn it. Wow. As baffling as the motives are for this whole crime, it is the perfect crime. Like, they are getting away with murder and selling all of Art's shit. But then Alan still wouldn't quit taking money out of the IHOP register. This gave the IHOP franchise more red flags, so they did a more thorough investigation into the management team. And I know what you're thinking. they're going to get suspicious and report Art missing. No. That's when IHOP made the discovery that the actual acting manager on paper was Alan, and then they did a little deeper dive and found out Alan had actually worked for the IHOP franchise years before and was fired and banned from ever working for them again because he stole a deposit bag with around $2,000 in it. So a couple days before Christmas in 1983, the IHOP was seized by IHOP headquarters, and Dee was now without a job. Panicked, Dee called the broker for the house, the one that she got the other mortgage from, and said that Art wanted to take out another mortgage. See, Dee was posing as Art's secretary to the broker. Dee told the broker that Art was still out of town, but he still wanted to take out another mortgage on his home, and it worked, and she was able to get another mortgage. And what's crazy, though, is Dee did all this. She didn't even have direct access to Art's accounts. Alan did. So the money went directly into Art's account, meaning the money went straight to Alan. And guess what? Alan did not make a single payment on either of the mortgages, nor give Dee any large sums of money. This is crazy to me. Dee and Alan ended up forging power of attorney, so they were able to easily sell off Art's remaining possessions. This included his artwork, theater pipe organs, his land, and later his house. They literally sold everything but his car because it was in repossession. And of course it was in repossession because they didn't pay the car payment. Sometimes Dee and Alan, who posed as Art, would pretend to either be business partners, sometimes they'd pretend to be married, and sometimes they'd pretend Dee was just Art's secretary. Just whatever fit for the scenario that they were in and what they were trying to buy or sell. They sold the land and house for $150,000, but by the time they paid both the mortgages off, they had $15,000. Of course, that means Alan had $15,000 because he didn't split any of the money with Dee. All in all, Dee made out with collectively a couple hundred dollars for her effort in this huge crime that they got away with. Susan tried to tell her mom all along that Alan was using her, he didn't care about Dee, and that he should at least be giving Dee half the money. After everything was sold and the con had run its course, the gravity of what Dee did and what Susan had been telling her all along began to settle in. She was haunted by her actions. She began drinking heavily when she saw Susan, who, by the way, like I said, is only like 17, sneaking alcohol into her apron before her work shift. Something in Dee broke. What was she doing? What had she gotten her daughter involved in? Who had she let into her and now her daughter's life? So Dee asked her friend, who we will call Tammy, to go out one night drinking. Tammy agreed because she was afraid Dee would get drunk and drive. The next morning, I don't know what came over Dee, but her, Tammy, and Susan all sat down at the kitchen table together. Susan got a pen and paper, and while Susan wrote down everything, Dee told her best friend Tammy what happened from start to finish, including the murder of Art and Bessie, the dissolving of his property, and then all the women signed the confession. Dee said that she wanted somebody to know and have it documented just in case something happened to her. It occurred to her, since she no longer served Alan a purpose and because he was obviously not in love with her, he might want to kill her as well later. She wanted the confession to only be used if something happened to her. Okay, so I want to backtrack really quick. After Dee moved out of Art's house, but before her and Alan sold the house and property, a concerned friend of Art's went by his house just to check things out. They were worried because Art had literally fallen off the face of the earth. Not only was it odd to them that Art was selling all his stuff, but the way the property had been left, it like wasn't maintained. The house was completely disheveled when they took a look around. It only raised his friend's level of concern higher. So that friend noticed Bessie's trailer was missing and some overdue bills. And that's when they knew, like, okay, I was concerned. I thought things were weird, but now I think something's very wrong. So that friend made a phone call to their friend who worked at the police department, but the police officer didn't really take their concerns too seriously and explained that there isn't really anything that they can do because it doesn't sound like there's any proof of foul play. Okay, so now that we've backtracked, we're going to go back to Tammy. That's Dee's friend who Dee just gave a full confession to. Tammy told a woman that we're going to call Sarah everything that Dee told her. Sarah was either Tammy's friend or roommate. So Tammy tells Sarah everything. Sarah writes it all down and then went to her police officer friend, who I'm going to call Derek. Derek put Sarah on the back burner, though. he went on a family vacation. That's probably why he put her off. Derek was not about to let anything come between him and that vacation, not even a murder investigation. The man was already dead. He could wait. But Sarah was afraid, since she tipped off a police officer, someone was going to find out and come after her. So she just kept calling and calling and calling Derek. Derek just kept blowing her off, though, because he said that he basically didn't believe the story that this Tammy lady even told Sarah. Derek eventually relented and agreed to meet up at Art's property and said if he could find anything that corroborated the story, he'd look into it. While at the property, Derek went into the shed barn thing where Dee and Alan had originally placed the wardrobe that they put Art's body in before tossing it in the dirt hole. Because Art's remains had been in there for so long, talking about the shed inside of the wardrobe, Derek could smell an odor and saw a red fluid on the floor that could be consistent with remains. And if this fluid leaked out of the wardrobe from Art's remains, it did corroborate the story that Tammy told Sarah, and Derek agreed to investigate further. So Sarah and Tammy are quickly made into informants. They show police where everybody lived and even knew the company that dug the trash hole. Police went and spoke with the excavator, who confirmed the story that the police had been told about the hole he dug, why he dug it, etc. Detectives went out to Art's property, which had been purchased by a man named Higgins. They asked him who he bought the property from, and he stated Art Venetia. Then they flashed a photo of Art, and Higgins didn't recognize that photo at all. Police knew then that Alan was likely posing as Art. Next, they asked if there was any freshly dug dirt on the property, and Higgins pointed them to a supposed trash hole that had been filled. Wayne Tidbell, the man who Alan and Dee hired, came out to help police redig the trash hole, and they recovered two bodies, Art and his mother, Bessie. First, police picked up Dee. Alan hadn't been at work like they anticipated, so they had to track him down. Dee pretended that she didn't know anything and maintained that Art was in North Carolina, but then she overheard on the dispatch radio the code for two dead bodies and that they'd been located at Art's property. She recognized the address. And since she used to be a dispatcher and had tried to join the police force years ago, she recognized those codes and immediately knew the jig was up. Dee ultimately confessed to everything. She gave everyone up and even gave police the address to Mike's service station, where they could find Mike and probably Bill. Eventually, the police do track down Alan a short time later, and he lied. Oh my God, did the man lie. He claimed he was forced at knife point to go with the two men that killed Art, and further forced against his will to participate in the death of Bessie and the liquidating of all Art's stuff. What? The police didn't have enough to hold Alan initially, though. After questioning him, they had to let him go. What? What? But Dee, having thought she could not possibly be charged with murder, agreed to sign a written full confession at midnight. And when she was done with her confession, she asked if she could go home now. Dee did not view herself as guilty of these murders. In her opinion, she was maybe guilty of grand theft. The police told her that she couldn't leave and that a jury would decide her fate. Dee was ultimately charged with two counts of murder in the first degree. She was shocked. And in Florida, there is no bail for murder in the first degree. Florida don't fuck around, dude. They do not mess around. It literally never occurred to Dee that she would be charged with murder, like, ever at all. What the fuck were these people thinking? Okay, so next, police interviewed Susan, and Susan handed over the signed confession from that morning in the kitchen with Dee's friend Tammy. Susan was a very strong witness for the prosecution, and the confession Dee outlined gave the entire crime and motive. Susan could corroborate that. Dee did encourage Susan to just do the right thing and tell the truth. She didn't want her to lie. She didn't want to try and have her daughter protect her. She was going to own what she did. She wasn't that kind of person. So now they have what they actually need to arrest Alan, I think. So he gets arrested. Then police track down Mike. And Mike acted like he had no idea why they would even be looking for him. When they told him Dee gave a full confession, he said he did it because he was afraid of Bill, and he said Bill made him go with him. Mike maintained he was just the driver, and it was Bill who killed Art, not him, and it was Bill who killed Bessie. In jail before trial, Mike found a way to call Dee and ask that she recant her confession. In return, he told her he'd have some guys bust her out of jail. He also tried to offer a police officer $50,000 to throw out his file. What an idiot. So how did these idiots pull off such a crime and nearly get away with it? Bill was really hard to track down, but when they did find him and bring him in, he blamed Mike. 3 years, the whole gang waited to go to trial. Bill, Mike, Dee, and Alan were all charged with the murders of Bessie and Art. Dee still didn't see herself equally guilty in the murders of Art and Bessie and didn't think she could possibly be found guilty of murder in the first degree. The mother and the daughter both became clean of drugs and alcohol and gave of their lives to God while waiting the trial to start. Wow, that's what it took, guys. That's what it took. Dee, Mike, Bill, and Alan all went to trial together as co-defendants in June of 1987. They all faced the death penalty as well. Everyone but Alan testified. Alan didn't testify under the advisement of his lawyer. Susan and Dee told the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Mike and Bill blamed each other mostly. Everyone who'd purchased property from Dee and Alan testified, as well as Tammy, Sarah, Derek, anyone pretty much with any relevancy to the whole crime. They were all found guilty of both counts of murder in the first degree, and each were handed a life sentence and a death sentence. So Bill was sentenced to death for the murder of Art, and he got a life sentence for the murder of Bessie. While Dee, Alan, and Mike were sentenced to death for the murder of Bessie, and they were handed a life sentence for the murder of Art. Dee and Alan were also charged in a slew of burglary and theft charges. Eventually, all the death sentences were overturned to life sentences, which I don't like that. You know, I love me some death penalty when it warrants it. Dee died at the age of 64 in prison, October 7th of 2002. James Allen Bryant, a.k.a. Allen, is 66 and still incarcerated in the men's Tomico C1 prison facility. What a long time. Like, he was young when this crime happened. He was in his 20s. Michael Irving is 79 and still incarcerated in the men's Martin C1 prison facility. And William Rhodes, a.k.a. Bill Rhodes, is 74 and also still incarcerated in the men's Zephyrhills C1 prison facility. Y'all, I winged those prison names, so please forgive me. What a con, guys. Wow. Talk about the almost perfect crime for nothing. It's so important to take control of your life if you have addictive tendencies, you guys. Seriously, take care of yourselves, okay? Thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye.